Welcome to The Honest Report, a weekly podcast analyzing media coverage of the Arab Israeli conflict, anti-Semitism, and radical Islamic terrorism.
They attacked by air, land, and sea, taking Israel by surprise during a major Jewish holiday. Now, 13 and a half hours after Hamas launched its audacious assault, Israel says it's at war.
Israel is at war. We didn't want this war. It was forced upon us in the most brutal and savage way. But though Israel didn't start this war, Israel will finish it.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says when it comes to destroying Hamas, quote, nobody will stop us.
Here's your host, Rob Walker.
Over the last 5 months, Raheem Mohammed has become one of Canada's most recognizable opinion columnists on the Hamas-Israel war. Yet the Calgary-based commentator, writing in the National Post, has also made a name for himself as a vocal advocate for Israel and a harsh critic of the moral turpitude that has allowed disinformation to fester. While commentators are certainly entitled to their own views, but not their own facts, that simple yet profound difference has nevertheless been lost by so many reporters and columnists alike, regardless of the platform. In this week's podcast, Raheem joins us to discuss his perspective on the state of the news media when it comes to covering the Hamas-Israel war, how he would rate the coverage, and what his predictions for the news media are for the near future. Welcome to the Honest Report podcast. Raheem Mohammed, welcome to the Honest Report podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Robert.
The pleasure is all ours. You are, very outspoken, of course, opinion columnist at the National Post on a number of subjects. Certainly, when it comes to the Israel-Hamas war, you have certainly voiced your opinion. For example, there's one piece in mid-February where you accused Justin Trudeau of dancing to Hamas's tune. Mm-hmm. What has prompted you to write so vociferously about this subject?
Sure. So first of all, I wish I could take credit for the headline, but that's all my editor, Carson Jurema. That's one of the better headlines he's come up with, so I want to give proper attribution. But this is something that you sort of can't ignore. I believe October the 7th was the largest single-day massacre of Jews, since the Holocaust. It's a conflict that, while taking place in foreign soil, has implicated a number of Canadians. I believe there were seven Canadian casualties on October the 7th. And we've seen here in Canada, which is more my immediate focus, I think we've seen a disturbing level of social disintegration. If you look at the targeting of things like synagogues, Jewish-owned businesses, even on the other side, and I think to a lesser extent, the targeting of mosques. So I think you have seen this event not only sort of taking place and playing out in Gaza, but also exposing some terrors and some frictions in Canadian cultural pluralism.
I actually want to do quote the piece. I know they quoted the headline there, but I do want to quote just a segment of that column. You wrote, quote, Justin Trudeau, who hasn't hesitated to play armchair quarterback throughout Israel's war in Gaza, despite not stepping foot on Israeli soil himself since October 7th, is now actively helping Hamas mount its last stand defense against an IDF that sits on the one-yard line. I want listeners to fully understand the sort of the rhetorical strength that you're coming at this. A critic might say that there's a lot of conflicts in the world, certainly a lot of issues in Canada, but why specifically is it partially the response, the heightened tensions that have taken place here in the streets of Canada, not exclusively, of course, but elsewhere as well? Or is there a larger sort of issue at play, a larger proxy war, if you will, that needs to be commented on?
Sure. So for me, I've unambiguously and unashamedly, and I know there are complexities, but I've seen it from day one as a civilizational struggle. Israel being the only democracy in the region, being an imperfect society of laws, but a society of laws and a pluralistic democracy nonetheless, I think this is, it's not hyperbole to say this is an existential conflict, and sort of the immediate foe is Hamas, but you have other actors, Iran, a major one, that have significant stakes in the conflict and in the outcome of the conflict. So I think a level of solidarity is imperative, given the gravity of the conflict and given I think the potential negative ramifications for the entire democratic world, if we see, you know, either Hamas, you know, come out of this still operational, or you know, God forbid, a kind of Hamas rally and Hamas making gains out of this conflict.
And how would you rate the level of commentary that we've seen from the Fifth Estate, the news media, over the last 5 months in this country?
So I will say there are a number of challenges. None of us can get into Gaza. You know, on the ground reporting in Gaza is challenging, and you know, you're dealing with the fog of war. So getting baseline statistics, getting you know, kind of agreed upon facts, is challenging. But at the same time, I think we've seen here in Canada quite a few sloppy editorial practices. So one of them I've noticed is uncritically citing figures that have been produced and published by the Gaza Controlled Health Authority. You know, you can use those figures as a baseline, but it should be noted that, you know, this is an agency that works under the umbrella of Hamas. So sort of take those figures into account when you're citing them. So it's sloppiness like that that I've seen, sort of less than rigorous reporting, notwithstanding that there are substantial challenges in reporting on a war, you know, halfway across the world in these circumstances.
Do you attribute this to, you've called it sloppy? Is it sloppy? Some might say there is an ideological play. Is it laziness? What explains this sort of, because what you're describing, for example, the uncritical regurgitation of Hamas, often uncredited casualty data, is it just sloppiness? Is there something more at play? I mean, what explains the ubiquitousness of this practice?
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine it varies from outlet to outlet. But to me, it is something, you know, that this is, you know, the entity that unilaterally broke a ceasefire, you know, unilaterally sprung upon an unprovoked attack, or at least an attack without direct provocation on October the 7th, to suggest that it doesn't have incentives to misrepresent or inflate those numbers is something that I feel like, and I understand that across the board, media outlets have let go fact checkers. There are certain elements of rigor that, due to economic circumstances, have fallen by the wayside. But for me, as someone who's relatively new to journalism, I've been doing this for seriously maybe a year and a half, 2 years. I don't have any formal training of journalism. I mean, this seems like a very elementary detail to overlook. So, I mean, I don't want to cast aspersions or you know, suggest that there's any kind of far-reaching conspiracy, but it is quizzical to me that you do see those kind of basic fundamental errors with some regularity across a number of outlets.
Are there other areas with respect to this conflict that you've seen the same level of journalistic errors, sloppiness, etc.?
So we're dealing with a small community globally, the Jewish community, that historically has been the subject of a number of different tropes, conspiracy theories, one of which is this notion that I think there are 15 million Jews in the world, that somehow these 15 million Jews control the world's media, that they control major media outlets in the West. So you and I were just talking about a piece offline. You and I were talking about a piece by Sri Pradkar of the Toronto Star that came out on Friday. It was specifically targeting a tweet from former Prime Minister Stephen Harper as an example of Western pro-Israel bias. With pieces like that, I think columnists need to exercise, I think, special caution to ensure that they're not trafficking in any of these tropes. They're not casting aspersions on Jews, broadly speaking, that sort of could expose the Jewish community to even more sort of anti-Semitism and more of the kind of vitriol we've seen over the past 4.5 months. So again, I think when it comes to being aware of those tropes, when it comes to avoiding those tropes, we have seen a level of sloppiness, and I don't want to cast aspersions on anyone's intentions. I can't, you know really anyone's intentions, but it does strike to me that it's something that goes on too often, and it's something that you would hope for a higher level of professionalism in the media.
So you mentioned Sri Pradkar's column in the Toronto Star. Would you like to perhaps, because it's timely, update us in terms of what you've written, her piece, and what specifically you took issue with?
So with Ms. Pradkar, I think we need to look at broader context. So for a period of time, she was the internal, diversity and inclusion ombudsperson at the Toronto Star. There were a lot of concerns, particularly from Jewish employees, of how she handled that job. I think Jesse Brown of Canada Land had an expose about it in December. So she's a person who I think has a track record. But in this piece, for instance, she refuses to use the term terrorist. She uses the term gunman when discussing Hamas attackers on October the 7th. She also, at one point in the article, draws a false equivalency between the October the 7th attacks, which I believe ended up with a body count of somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,200 civilians, between a bloodless raid on a mosque in East Jerusalem in the spring of 2021, in which worshippers were subdued with rubber bullets and I believe stun grenades by Israeli security forces. So with that sort of thing, the context is very important. I think it's important in particular to avoid false equivalencies where there's one side that has stated, that their end goal is the destruction of the other side. I think a kind of counterpoint style of quote unquote balanced journalism can be dangerous, and it can be misleading when you're dealing with foes that have radically different ideologies and radically different intentions.
When you're dealing in a situation, as you've described, it's a civilizational battle, good versus evil. Is this a kind of message that is difficult for people, difficult for people to wrap their minds around, very unpalatable? In your view, is this perhaps one of the factors that, in not just in the news media, but even in the column or commentary aspect of the news media, that's made it very difficult for people to sort of understand it, and they think of it more as a war of real estate as opposed to ideology? Or do people understand it? They just look at it a different perspective.
Yeah, so I think for a lot of us, there's still a level of shock and disbelief surrounding October the 7th. So it wasn't just the body count. It was the way in which people were killed. And it was the fact that so much of the carnage was live streamed. We saw so much of the carnage as it happened. So I think for a lot of us, and even I've dealt with it, there's a sort of cognitive dissonance in that, you want to be sympathetic. And I am broadly sympathetic to the plight of the Palestinian people. You want to, you don't want to think that there's pure evil out there. And I think what we saw on October the 7th, at least from Hamas fighters, the glee with which the murders were carried out, entire families, the sadism, the use of sexual violence, that was evil. And I think it's a very challenging thing for people to get their heads around. And I think you're seeing, some of that cognitive dissonance in a number of people. I would put myself in that category who have been, historically sympathetic to the Palestinian plight. Historically, I've favored a two-state solution. And I think it's very difficult to reconcile that context with, just the pure evil and depravity that we saw on that day.
When there's a lot of, I would say, messaging and massaging of what's going on, and it's into very black and white in terms of that, that there's one side that's evil and there's one side that is imperfect as it may be, is that something that you think particularly younger demographic would be susceptible to hearing, or does that just sound too anathema to a particular worldview?
Well, I think in particular with the younger demographic, so I'm kind of on the older side of the millennial, demographic. So I'm in my late 30s. I'm probably part of the last generation of Canadian high schoolers. We're pretty much across the board. During Remembrance Day, we got a visit from a Holocaust survivor. You know, I think you've lost the connection between the Holocaust and October the 7th and continuing anti-Semitism, you know, because you have a loss of memory with, you know, fewer people who survived the Holocaust are among us. And, you know, there's less awareness among, you know, teenagers and young adults. And I think that plays into, I think a more uncharitable view of the Jewish side. I believe I saw research out of the United States where two-thirds of 18 to 24-year-olds view Jews, not Israelis, but Jews, as people with power and oppressors. So I think, you know, we've lost that historical connection, and it's translating into less of an understanding of the broader context of sort of why Israel exists in the first place. And the lineage of anti-Semitism that connects both the Holocaust and October the 7th.
Now, as somebody, you know, Raheem, of course, you are, you know, you're a Muslim Canadian. Mm. Do you find it, what are your perspective when you see some of the commentary trying to position this as sort of a Jew versus Muslim kind of an approach? I mean, how important is it for, in your mind, voices like yours to come out and speak and seek to reframe that?
So I'm in a weird position. I mean, my surname is Muhammad, and you can't get around that, but I happen to be an Ismaili Canadian. So we're an offshoot of Shia. Historically, we've had good relations with Jews. So our spiritual leader, we know him as Maulana Hazar Imam. You may know him as the Aga Khan. You know, he's for years been on record, you know, supporting Israel's existence, calling on Israel's neighbors to recognize its existence. I would also say there are elements in the Iranian community here in Canada that have been quite vocally pro-Israel because they were quite quick to connect the October the 7th attacks with the regime in Iran, to whom most Iranian Canadians, most Canadians here in Iran are opposed. So I think you have, you know, Muslim Canadians are not by and large a monolith. I wouldn't purport to speak for all Muslim Canadians, but I would hope, you know, if we saw any religious minority or ethnic minority terrorized and targeted to the extent that Jews have been here in Canada since October the 7th, that we would have people, you know, across the spectrum of all ethnicities, of all walks of life, speak out against it.
Raheem, thank you so much for your time and for sharing your perspective and your experiences with us today. Certainly looking forward to reading your next piece in the Post, and thank you very much again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Robert.
And that's today's edition of the Honest Report podcast. If you haven't done so yet, please subscribe to our mailing list, our podcast channel, and follow us on social media for the most up-to-date news. If you like what you've heard, please consider a donation to support our continued efforts at www.honestreporting.ca/donate. Until next time, thank you so much for listening.